Welcome to Open Book on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Tony Taccone, the artistic director of Berkeley Rep. And we're going to discuss the upcoming season. We're going to discuss the previous season and some other questions regarding theater. But first, I want to start by talking about the show that is running right now and will be running through April 10th, which is Ruined by Lynn Nottage. How did you come across Ruined?
Well, actually, I had been a housemate of Lynn Nottage's at Sundance several years ago, and when she was just about to go into production for the play, and so I got a kind of blow-by-blow account of what she was up to. We became fast friends, and she's a fantastically inspiring person and brilliantly intelligent, and so I was really intrigued, and then I read the play, which she happened to have, so that she gave me a copy, and I read it, and I was just knocked out by it.
That was before it won the Pulitzer.
It was far, yes, far earlier than that.
At that point, you knew it would be produced. How does the timing of something like that work? In terms of when you set it up, when it's ready, and that had played elsewhere before because it won the Pulitzer.
Actually, it was premiering at the Manhattan Theater Club. I had heard that it was going to be there. I followed the life of the show very carefully, and as soon as it appeared, it sort of caused an immediate reaction of just a lot of acclaim, a lot of praise. It's a very, very powerful play about a difficult subject, and so a lot of people were taken with not just Lynn's skill as an architect, if you will, but her ability to create really empathetic characters, thereby taking a situation which is almost unwatchable and making it irresistible. It's quite a feat.
The story takes place in the Congo during the Civil War and concerns some women who are holed up in, I guess, a brothel, you'd call it, brothel bar, and it's their only way to survive. What blew me away was the set. Is that similar to the set that was in New York?
No, it's not. This is a production that's been directed by Liesl Tommy, who directed the production up at OSF, Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and for us. And so she had a different take on the set. I think she was really intrigued by trying to make the environment manifest and detailed in a way that the production in New York didn't really try to do.
And the stars among them is Tanya Pitano, who I remember from Weeds. I'm watching it. I'm going, wow, she's terrific, and she was terrific in Weeds. How did you bring her on board?
Tony was here in Polk County years ago. She was here in a show which was a rediscovery of a Lorraine Hansberry play that we found and that we did, I think, probably like 5 years ago now. So she was in our Rolodex in casting the show because it was a co-production between us and La Jolla Playhouse and the Huntington. It's a very long run. I mean, you're talking about an actor giving up 9 months of their life to this particular play, and that's a long time to take yourself out of pilot season, out of consideration for, you know, like a lot of other projects. And so it required a dedication and a commitment. Also, you're looking for somebody. That's a very difficult part. It's like the mother courage of Lynn's world. And so Tony is somebody who we just loved and we identified. We basically like pleaded with her over a course of a couple of months to just please come and do it, and she did.
I don't know. Maybe this is just happenstance, but I noticed that a lot of the actors involved in the show had Shakespearean backgrounds, and I wonder if there's a connection or it's just because they're good actors.
Well, I think any play that deals with linguistic complexity, almost by nature, there's a correlation between that and what you call Shakespearean language, just the ability to sort of parse out complicated ideas quickly with the right syntax, with the right emphasis, with the right melody line. These are all requirements of Shakespeare's language, and they translate really well to a modern play that needs the same thing.
Tony Taccone, I noticed someone is listed as the dramaturge. What does the dramaturge do in a play that's already been performed several times?
Well, every theater has a dramaturg, and so I think that while the dramaturg in this production, you know, didn't need to be working with the playwright to revise the text, dramaturg is there to provide the cast and the director with all the historical background that's necessary to immerse themselves into the situation that the play describes. And so there's a critical function that the dramaturg plays, which is to do all that background research, winnow it down to something which is digestible in a relatively short period of time, and to make it clear. And for those people in the cast who need different kinds of access, they're there to say, go here, go there, go over there.
And the accents of the actors, any of them from Africa with the accents, or did they all have to learn it?
All have to learn it. But it's part of the skill set of actors. It's common that actors are asked to work in accents. I think the severity of this accent, the unknown quality of it, presented some issues in terms of just challenge. But, you know, when you're working on a play like that, you're trying to bring a certain level of authenticity to it. So you're aware way ahead of time that this is going to be one of your tasks.
And there's a point at the beginning of Act Two, maybe I'm giving something away, where people come into the audience, the fourth wall is actually broken. Was that originally in the script then?
I think it emerged out of the show in New York. It was something that they played with, and then they found that they really liked it. One of the things that Lynn and Kate Horsky, who was the original director on the show, were really looking to do was to try to find ways to keep inviting people to look at something that they may not want to look at. One of the genius strategies of the show is the use of music. I mean, there's a lot of music in the show, and the music is it's playful, it's joyful, it's sexy. There's a buoyancy to it that lifts the events and releases the audience into a little bit more of a relief from what they're seeing in some of the action of the play. So it's really helpful.
There's a sense of danger in Act Two that is pretty overwhelming. I usually don't get that in any play, and I guess that's due to both the director and the everything.
Yeah. It's obviously in the play in terms of the actions that she's described, the language that she's using, the beats that she's outlined. But it's up to the director and the cast to execute all that and to discover for themselves what the individual artists on stage have to bring to that situation.
And what role do you as artistic director play? Do you just kind of sit in the back and stay out of it, or do you intrude or what?
I smoke very large cigars and drink Cavassier as often as possible. No, if only that were true. I serve as an overseer. I mean, I basically talk to the director. I give notes, I watch run-throughs, and we give feedback as to what's happening. In this case, one of our staff members, Les Waters, who's our fantastic director himself, he was appointed as the point person in the show. So he traveled to the various locations. He went to rehearsals. He gave little notes.
Tony Taccone, the next show is going to be Three Sisters, a rewrite based on a literal translation by Sarah Rule, with Les Waters directing, and it kind of reminds me of the version of Seagull that recently played in Marin. Was there any communication between the two theater companies, or is it happenstance that Chekhov hits both within a few months?
It's happenstance, and I think it's common. I mean, Chekhov is just one of those writers. Those four plays that he wrote, not to mention the short stories, but the four plays have obviously become part of the repertoire of many theaters around the United States, and for good reason. They're great, great plays. And so basically a lot of us look for just an opening when one of the plays hasn't been done for a few years so we can actually have at it ourselves.
What's the relationship of that show to Yale Rep?
Well, Yale is our partner in this play. The production is going to go intact from here to Yale. It's going to open their season next year. So I think James Bundy, who's the head of Yale Rep, will be here today for the first rehearsal. We're working with their staff on a whole host of issues.
There were some comments regarding the Marin show. It may have veered a little bit too much into contemporary usage. Do you see that as a problem here? It's something you're not worrying about? Or?
Well, I think you focus and you are concerned about all of those things. You know, we're not removing our production from the time period. You know, Sarah Rule is an astonishing writer in her own right, and she has a kind of elliptical, poetic sensibility that I think she's very sensitive and very fragile to what the power of the language is, and I think she brings all of that, you know, to the work, which I think is a good marriage between Chekhov and her. But yes, whenever you're translating or moving a play into a different period, into a different time frame, you have to be very careful about how you do it. For some people, there's always going to be a problem because it's too jarring, or it takes them out of the world of the play, or they feel less invested somehow if they feel that there's an anachronism in there that sort of feels like it's not seamlessly interwoven into the text. Yeah, you worry about all these things.
What I found interesting is that the people who were very familiar with Chekhov kind of winced a couple of times, but a friend of mine who'd never seen Seagull, he said it brought him into the play. So there is that as well, particularly for newer people.
Yeah, I think your observation is right on. I mean, I feel like the more somebody knows a play, actually the more ownership they have over it. Those people who know the play are probably a lot more aware of the liberties anybody's taking when they veer away into a kind of modern syntax or whatever, and they object to it frequently. So you can never really win.
Then comes a show that was recently announced, Anna Deavere Smith, a one-woman show, Let Me Down Easy, which opens, I guess, May 28th. That replaced Rita Moreno, which I guess she had surgery and you had to find a replacement. How did that come about? Were you panic-stricken for a while?
You know, I kind of live with panic as a best friend, so to speak. You know, panic sleeps right next to me, so it's not an uncommon experience I have. I am writing Rita's show for her. And so when Rita came to us and said, look, my knee isn't healing as fast as I would like, because she had this operation, which is basically she has a new knee, and she's 79, and she wants to dance in the show. And she doesn't want anybody feeling sorry for her or feeling like this is like a pathetic attempt at moving around. And so we were all sitting there in a workshop in January. I mean, she was in rehab, and she was doing fairly well, but the ambition of the show was such that when she came and said, look, I would love a little bit of an extension here, I was like, this is a good idea. I did it because I felt like it was in the best interest of the show to do it. So she's going to open the next season for us.
And that's going to be the first show of the next season. Before we talk about that, I'd like to talk a little bit about the previous season, because it was remarkable. An American Idiot has had quite an afterlife. Did you kind of expect that?
Let's put it this way. I was very hopeful. I'm not sure expect is ever a word that you can ever use without the gods dinging you for using it. So I'm very cautious about that. But we were very hopeful because American Idiot is obviously, you know, the signature album of one of the world's biggest rock bands. And so we felt like there was going to be a natural audience for it, and that if we could make the show good, that there would be an expanded audience for it. And sure enough, that's what, you know, like exactly what happened.
And girlfriend, a friend of mine went like 5 times because he was just blown away by it. Is that going to have any kind of afterlife?
We're very hopeful of that, too. It's being considered seriously for a New York commercial run.
And In the Wake just opened as well. Is the version that opened in New York, was that similar to the
one? Of course. I mean, there's not a lot of time to radically rewrite the play, but she made some great changes for the version in New York. And that's part of the expectation, is that when you map out a road for a show, you're building in time in between the production so that the writer has a chance to digest and to make some changes that will improve the text.
When you talk about mapping out a show, I mean, In the Next Room eventually went to Broadway, got rave reviews, and couldn't stay open. Does that change the way you think about what you can do with serious shows that might go on, which would include shows, say, you know, coming up in the next season?
No, I don't think that way very much. I think that once you start trying to move shows, once you start planning on a move before they've even happened, I think you're dead. Our goal is to make the work here be the best that it can be. And obviously, we're in a position now where we're in dialogue with a lot of people that if the show touches a nerve, if people from the outside feel that it can move, then fine. But we don't go, oh my God, we can't do that show because it might not move in New York.
Well, also, regional theater is becoming more and more important as the old way that they did things for Broadway shows. The road show has died, and the replacement, you know, which is 1,000 performances of Spider-Man before it opens,
right.
That's not really an effective way to work. So the entire way theater happens in America is shifting.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And it's shifted even once again in the last 5 years. I mean, the commercial pressure is very real in the nonprofit world. I mean, because you're under more scrutiny, and the bottom line has become more and more present.
Before we move on, the 3 other shows from the past season, Compulsion is now in New York. Mm-hmm. Lemony Snicket's Composer is Dead I thought it was extraordinary. I couldn't figure out how half of it was done. That was a very different kind of show than you've done, because there's puppets and film and one guy on stage. How did that come together?
It was a very unique process, I have to say. I mean, and obviously the sort of dramaturgy of it did not describe a well-made play. I mean, because a guy comes on stage for 10 minutes and does a kind of failed comic routine as a joke, and then that morphs into an interactive movie featuring puppets and a live actor who has to memorize every single amount of space between his line and the film line. It was really challenging. And that gave way to the shock of the evening where the screen and the curtain fly away, and which reveals a kind of 19th century Victorian puppet theater, which was full of just splendor and magic and visual delight. Phantom Limb, the puppet company, were the designers behind the show, I think are just brilliant. I think that they're astonishing. And I think that was clear. I mean, the people had personal relationships with those puppets. I mean, it was the only time that we have ever kind of let the audience kind of take pictures of a show afterwards, because it was so, like, the curtain would come down and people would just, like, rush to the stage to get a closer look at the puppets, and because they felt so alive, so visually stimulated, it felt real. That was really fun.
Another show that I loved, but people seem to have mixed feelings about, was a show called Concerning Strange Devices from the Distant West. Just blew me away because of the Japanese connection, and I thought it was an amazingly staged show. I loved that show.
You know, I loved the show. I thought the production was fantastic, and I was really disappointed that it didn't capture the public imagination. I mean, people liked it. Some people liked it, but some people didn't like it at all. I mean, a lot of people felt like it was too hard to follow, which I have to say I don't really understand, because when you actually question those people about what's happening, they all got it. But it felt like it was maybe a little bit too much work for people, that the mysteries of the plot were too embedded for people to easily access. But I think it's a brilliantly written play. Naomi Izuka is just, you know, like an astonishing talent.
Theater is all about risk. So, I mean, you're going to find things that are a little bit too risky for some people. Is there any show where you, or maybe every show, but I mean certain shows where you keep your fingers crossed because you really don't know how they're going to respond?
I think you'd be a little bit shocked to realize that the answer is yes to every single show. I mean, I think that when you're doing a new play, and we do a lot of them, when you're doing a new play, it's really kind of an unknown quantity until the audience comes. I mean, you try to do everything that you can to get as much information about that beforehand. You do workshops. You do public readings. You invite the audience in to participate in some way so you can get a reading or a feel for it. But until that first crowd of strangers comes hauling in night after night after night, giving you consistent feedback, you really don't know what you have. And I think with any new play, that sensation is always pretty high.
Garrick Perloff told me that one difference between the Bay Area audience and audiences elsewhere is Bay Area audience are very involved in process, which means they love these previews in a way that people don't seem to elsewhere. Have you found that?
I've never had that thought before. I've never tried to compare like our preview audiences. I can tell you this. The audience in the Bay Area is got to be one of the best audiences in the world. I mean, there is a spirit of openness here. If you could define the Bay Area with any kind of moniker, you'd have to say that there's a spirit of adventure, of the other, of the alternative. People come here for all kinds of reasons, but between Silicon Valley and its entrepreneurial spirit, and between the Castro and its entrepreneurial culture, and between schools of psychology and theology, every kind of alternative is here. And so just to live here, you're exposed to all these different ways of thinking. And so I think people come to the theater with a little bit more sense of openness, and it makes all the difference.
The upcoming season, we talked a little bit about Rita Moreno's show, which you wrote, but you're not directing.
Thankfully. I made a pact with myself that I wouldn't direct anything that I wrote, and I think it's a really smart thing to do, because I've been in a situation where I've actually hired a writer to direct their own work, and what happens inevitably is that the writer has to shut down and the director has to fix things that the writer hasn't fixed. I didn't want that to happen to my play. I wanted to be able to, as the writer, be able to focus entirely on what those issues were and not give in too early to having to cover up my bad mistakes.
The second show of the next season is How to Write a New Book for the Bible by Bill Kane, and that's a world premiere. Did that come through the auspices of Berkeley Rep?
No, it was a read. I mean, Bill's somebody who – we follow the writing careers in the of actively maybe like 300 writers in addition to the scripts that we receive from local writers. So we've been following his work for a while. He's had two plays that we've seen up in Ashland, the latest one being Equivocation, which was a really, really terrific script. And he was interested in us, and we were interested in him. So it was just kind of a happy marriage.
And then after that comes a play called Ghostlight, which you have written based, I guess, on incidents in the life of the director, Jonathan Mosconi. There are actually two books called Ghostlight right now. Right. One is a memoir by Frank Rich of the New York Times, and the other is a brilliant Irish novel by a writer named Joseph O'Connor.
Right. Well, I'm in good company. I hope I can hold my own slightly.
This particular play is about Jonathan Mosconi directing Hamlet and thinking about how his father was murdered.
Well, it's not quite that. I mean, there are three narrative lines in the play. First of all, the character of John Mosconi, you know, like in the play, is not an attempt to create a replication of John Mosconi, the real guy. It's not. People are going to think that. I've accepted that, but it's not the case. The character of John Mosconi talks and thinks a lot more like me than he does John Mosconi. John came to me as a friend and a colleague a couple of years ago and said, I want to do a piece about my dad. And he's never wanted to talk about his dad before. And he said, I don't want to do a biopic. I don't want to do something which is, you know, some boring sort of historical thing. I want to do a dream play. And I said, well, why? And he basically started to tell me stories. I mean, the first thing out of his mouth was, well, I was 14-year-old when my dad was assassinated, and I was in therapy for being paranoid that my dad would be assassinated when my dad was assassinated. So you start with that. So one of the narrative lines in the play is of a 14-year-old boy who's guarding his father's coffin. I made that up. And then the next narrative line is of a director named John Mosconi who wants to direct Hamlet, and he gets stuck on the ghost scene. He becomes obsessed with the ghost. Obviously, there's a connection between him and his dad, but he knows that rationally, but he's not dealing with it. And the third narrative line is of what happens in that guy's dream life. There are a whole set of characters that, and those set of characters come crashing through into his conscious life. So all three narratives weave their way into the play and resolve by the end of the play. So it's a completely fictional, imagined event. But yes, some of these things happened to John Mosconi, and they are descriptions of a person's grief. And they are particular to John because it's different when the parent that dies is a public figure who is part of history.
And also who seems to have been lost in the shuffle because of Harvey Milk.
Well, I think it's fair to say that George Mosconi has become an asterisk in the life of Harvey Milk. We all admire Harvey Milk tremendously. I mean, what he did for the gay movement is a matter of public record, and it was astonishing, and he was a charismatic guy. But I think it is an issue. It's certainly, like an issue for the Mosconi family that George's life, which is politically extraordinary, has been a little bit brushed aside because of the celebration of Harvey.
Mosconi transformed San Francisco politics because up to that point it was the establishment and the cronies who were running the city since the earthquake, and suddenly all of that was thrown out when he was elected.
Absolutely. The most astonishing feature of George Mosconi as a politician was his ability to include different disenfranchised elements of the community into the political process. The accounts of the party that happened at City Hall when he was elected and who was invited changed the landscape of San Francisco and threatened a lot of people. It threatened the old guard seriously. And in fact, you know, one could very rationally and reasonably state that Dan White's assassination of Milk and Mosconi was a political expression of the revenge of the old guard against this new alliance. And they struck back. And the exoneration, if you will, of Dan White at the sentencing only served to illuminate that contradiction.
I always think whenever I see Senator Feinstein, her career was over. Absolutely over.
Dead in the water. I mean, the great irony is that the tragedy catapulted her into not just the limelight, but she was the only person who really could take over. I mean, she was legally made mayor of the city and had to sort of bear the historical burden of what happened there too. And then by happenstance, she sort of slipped into this nexus of history and took off.
The next show there is the Molière, A Doctor in Spite of Himself. The earlier ones came out of Minnesota, is that correct?
What you're referring to there is that Theatre de la Jeune Lune,
yeah,
which doesn't exist anymore, actually. Yeah. We did The Miser by Molière featuring Steve Epp, who was also working on this show. Steve Epp is a fantastic actor, and he also starred in The Figaro that we did. Steve is responsible for writing the adaptation and for starring in the show. So really excited to have him back. He's a fantastic actor.
So this is, in some ways, this is a continuation from this great Theatre de Jeune Lune, which was an amazing company.
Yeah. You know, certainly like an attempt on our part to sustain them as artists and sustain their work.
And then there's Red, which is about Mark Rothko, Les Waters directing. That one played on Broadway, I think, with Alfred Molina in the lead.
Yeah. I mean, It's basically like a two-character play. It kind of swept all the Tony Awards that year. At the heart of Red is a deep, passionate, intense dialogue about the nature of life between a major, major painter, Rothko, and his assistant, and who share almost opposite worldviews. And so there's a really penetrating, discursive exploration of the nature of life and love and reality and art. And it's a, just a really, really smart play.
There are also two shows, The Christmas Show and another show. And you said, you told me before we went on the air that in the next couple of weeks, that one those should come together?
If they don't come together, you'll find my body in a small ravine in Berkeley. Yeah, that we are very hopeful that we'll be able to announce what those shows are in a few weeks.
A few other questions. Tiny Kushner, I know, is making it over to London. Did already.
Yeah, did already. It was great. We had a fantastic time there.
And you also brought The Great Game Afghanistan over. Are there any works that are going to be coming that are not scheduled and not really Berkeley Rep works like Great Game coming up?
Yeah, there are. Well, I can't announce them, but I can say they're going to be great. We're actually talking to some pretty high-profile people about particular projects. And then we're also, because of being in London and being in the company of some of the producers there, we're starting to strike up relationships there of shows coming from there and also coming from us to the London scene.
Speaking of what's happening over there, are you beginning to feel the effects? I when I talked to Andrew Rubasingham about it, she was heartsick about the cutbacks to funding in England. Yeah. Are you finding that in talking to these folks?
No doubt about it. I mean, they're facing the kind of draconian cuts. I mean, the British Council was talking about 40% cuts across the board. And while I don't think that's going to end up happening entirely, I think there are going to be a lot of huge cuts, and you're going to see some companies go under, if not a lot of companies go under.
Well, what she said is that if those cuts had happened earlier, Great Game would never, ever have been created. They wouldn't have had the money for it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, exactly. I mean, you know, The Great Game was unbelievable in terms of what it did. I mean, you know, when the leaders of the Pentagon go to see The Great Game at the urging of the British military leadership. I mean, that's just incredible. And the fact that they can sit there and in an intelligent way reflect upon what the ramifications are of what's being said, it was just a really, really, you know, like fantastic experience.
Yeah, my jaw dropped when I saw that Maureen Dowd article in the Times about it. It was just like, holy cow.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just not what you expect, but it was really validating and caused for a lot of good feeling.
The important part about the show playing here is that anyone who saw it, our views of Afghanistan had to change.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was so full of deeply contradictory information and emotion and ideas that it really challenged you. I mean, the thing that I was struck by sitting in the audience of A Great Game was that the production was asking me to participate in a different way. It wasn't asking me to just sort of passively watch and kind of feel something. It was asking me to really think actively about my preconceived ideas about Afghanistan and whether or not they were holding up given what was coming off the stage. And so the production was more or less addressing me as a citizen as opposed to a fawning audience member.
There's a show, two shows, Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs and The Last Cargo Cult, which were Mike Daisy's monologues. In some respects, both of them did similar things. Mm-hmm. Did he make his money back on The Last Cargo Cult?
He did. He did. He came out a little bit in the black in Berkeley, which I think was a relief. Not a lot, but a little bit. But interestingly enough, the piece that really caught the audience's imagination was the Steve Jobs piece. I just hadn't realized myself just how huge an icon Steve Jobs is for that many people. I mean, people were really fascinated. They wanted to know what Mike thought of Steve, who Steve was really like, you know, what he was really like. And I think some people took offense that of Mike's portrait of Steve, but the piece was really much more than a small description of Steve Jobs. The piece was like a description of how these electronic gadgets are made, where they're made, the labor force that makes them, the consequences of not looking carefully at how they're made. It was a really cool piece of theater.
While the show was running, all of the information about Jobs having to leave Apple suddenly comes out, and he comes back in the news. Did Mike ever think about changing it to incorporate any of that?
We did, and then we rejected it. It's very strict axiom in the theater. If you try to write atopically, events will outstrip you. By the time you've written it and spoken it, something else has happened. So we were concerned when Steve Jobs had another setback in his health right before the show opened, and we were concerned that would tilt the show in some strange way. And then we just decided to, like, stay the course, and it worked out fine.
Well, I mean, he could have died for all you know.
Yeah, of course. And then I think you're facing a whole different thing.
A friend of mine saw Avenue Q, and she said the scenes with Gary Coleman, they didn't work.
They're not the same thing. You're not open to it the same way.
A couple of other quick questions. Tony Kushner, I've heard rumors that you guys may be putting on Angels.
Where'd you hear that? That's a good rumor. Actually, you know, it's kind of hard because they wanted to do Angels at Marin, you know, and I really try to be very generous about that because there is a kind of economic pecking order, you know, in terms of who gets rights to what, and we're not at the top of the food chain, but we're not at the bottom. And so when a smaller theater wants the rights to something, we'll often get a call saying, is there any chance you're going to do this? And in the case of Angels, there really is a chance we're going to do it. I went back to see the show. I hadn't seen it in 20 years, and I just couldn't believe how well I knew it and how much I liked it as a play.
I just saw Millennium Approaches on – I watched the video for a friend of mine and was blown away.
Yeah. It's a fantastic play. It's a fantastic play.
Two other questions. The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide, is that ever going to come here?
It might. You know, I'm talking to Tony right now back and forth. He's in the middle of it, and so all he can talk about is, like, you know, slitting his wrists and jumping off bridges and things like that. So we offered them to come here first before it opened in New York, and they pass on that for lots of sound reasons economically because it's a really huge show and moving it around is hard. But I don't know if he wishes he was here right now.
And a show that opened on Broadway and closed on Broadway, I managed to get a chance to see it, came out of the public. And since you have a good relationship, Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson.
Right. I did make an inquiry about it. The rights are available, and I think the only thing that would prevent us from doing it, and it's a significant obstacle, is the money. It's not a small show. Once you pick a really big play, it knocks out a lot of other options for you, like in a year. So that's what's hard about that.
And what about co-productions? Like last year, the Brother Sisters play popped up at three different locations.
That was awesome. I thought that was a great experiment, and I thought it generated some Bay Area wide interest in a writer and a body of work, and I thought it was great that ACT collaborated with Marin and with Magic. I thought it was really a great – I know that Carrie's been very, very proactive in talking to me, too, about trying to break down some of the mythologies, some of the sort of stereotypical ideas about boundaries and who shouldn't be working with who, and I think that was a good first step.
I sometimes feel this rivalry that should not exist between you and ACT. It's like your colleague.
I don't think Carrie and I feel that, but I think a lot of other people do. Well, I think a lot of people are sort of get like vested interest in it, and I'm sure that the both of us hear from people who, you know, oh, I'm new. I love ACT because I've had it with that Berkeley rep, or I've had it with ACT. I'm over to Berkeley. I mean, you just sort of nod and go your way.
Well, one thing when I was interviewing Jason Minidakis, he said, what's interesting is how many people cross over and have multiple subscriptions.
Yeah, I think that that's awesome. I mean, it's great. I mean, when Lisa was here, she's the director of Ruined, and she gave a little speech to a group of our supporters, and she asked them how many people had seen the show at Ashland. I mean, and a lot of them had. And she was like, she said, I'm terrified. I'm in competition with myself.
One thing that Berkeley Rep has been doing, because a lot of people can't afford theater as it was, yet, of course, the cost of going to a 3D movie is pretty much the same as a lower cost.
Well, you know, I went to see a Cal basketball game last week. And I bought a $35 seat, which was general admission, and I was sitting in the rafters. I mean, I was sitting in the nosebleed seats, and I was like, $35 to sit up here. And I was like, we have a good deal going. So, I mean, obviously, yeah, if you want to come here on Saturday night and sit in the, you know, fourth row center, you have to pay for it. But there's lots of ways to get into the theater that are – easily affordable by lots and lots of folks.
Well, I see that previews are cost less. If you're 30 or under, if you're a student, if you're a senior, there's a teen night.
If you're a subscriber, they cost less. If you really want to get in cheap, you'd be an usher. Free.
And, and there's also, if you show up an hour before, there's a discount as well.
Yeah, there's a rush line.
So there are ways for people to see to see theater. I think for me, what's been happening, seeing as much as I'm starting to see, it's harder and harder to me to just spend even close to that kind of money going to a movie that I could watch at home for free. There's nothing like theater.
Yeah, I think there's a different experience entirely. I think it's one of the reasons why it's been hard to transmit plays onto the screen is because they don't translate well. Because when you walk into, I mean, all you've got to do is watch a show on the monitor in our lobby and then walk into the space. It's a profoundly different sensorial, emotional, intellectual experience. It's just different. It's live. It's right in front of you, and you taste it, and you smell it, and you breathe it, and it's a wonderful experience.
And, of course, the performances always change, or sometimes change. I mean,
sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse.
There are bad nights.
There are bad nights. Well, there are nights. I don't think the audience would notice necessarily like a bad night. But, yeah, there are nights when ashtrays fall off the table, when an actor – there. And in extreme situations, there are nights when actors get hurt or are suffering from something, you know, when you're sick and got the flu and you still go on, you still have to muscle it up. But sometimes those are the best performances. It's very hard to actually predict that. And there is a structure for every play. So a lot of the performances look like that they're the same, but they always change a little bit.
Well, the other thing I notice is that by the end of any performance, certainly a performance like Great Game, it's obvious, there's always a feeling that you're in there not on the stage, but you're in there with the performers and with everybody working on the show, that it's this, in some level, as an audience member, you're part of a group that encompasses everybody in the production.
Well, you're also part of a journey. I mean, the cast is going on like a journey with each other, and that is a real journey that happens in real time. And so you come for like a preview. I think one of the biggest experiments you can, you know, you should, if you're interested in theater, go to a preview. Like, go to the first preview and then go to see the same show towards the end of the run. It's not the same experience.
Stephen Sondheim told me that sometimes towards the end of a run, the performers start getting a little logy, but he may be talking about months into a show. Do you ever find toward the very end that you got to pep them up a little?
I don't think that happens just at the very end. I think it can happen in the middle. I think it can happen at the end. I think it can happen in a lot of places. I mean, I think that's why the stage manager is there. That's why directors go back and see the shows. They go back. I mean, George Abbott, the famous director in New York in the 30s, created hit after hit after hit. And a reporter saw him going back to see a show that had been open for a year. And he said, Mr. Abbott, why are you going back to see the show? The show's already a hit. He said, I'm going back to take out the improvements.
Tony Taccone, the upcoming season, you're going to be...
I'm not directing. I'm just writing. I'm writing two of them. I think that's enough. I think that's all the audience can stand.
Did you have any input on the HBO production of Wishful Drinking?
No, I did not. I mean, they paid me, which was great, but I did not have any input on that, and I didn't want any. I really didn't want to, you know, that show needed to be shot on its own terms. And also, they were going to they took like a 2-hour and 10-minute show and did it in like, you know, a little over an hour, and it just wasn't the same show.
And do you have any directing coming up that isn't affiliated with Berkeley Rep?
I've been asked by a number of people to come in and do shows. It's just a question of getting the time. I'm hopeful of getting to do a show outside of Berkeley Rep, you know, within the next year and a half.
And the final question is, in terms of the economy, how's Berkeley Rep doing these days?
I think we're doing well, with the caveat that it's a struggle in the sense that people don't have as much cash. I think raising money is harder. Having said all that, people's experience when they come here, I think, is as lively as it's ever been. I think people are really enjoying the work. Single tickle stands are really good. So having said all that, I think we're doing okay.
Are you going to be affected by any further cutbacks of the government, or are you pretty much free of that right now?
I think we're all affected by the cutbacks in the government. I mean, I don't think the amount of money is the huge issue, because the government has cut back the NEA so much so in the last, you know, 20 years that it's not like there's this huge pot of money out there. I think, though, symbolically and in real terms, it sends a message that is horrible. I mean, to cut the arts out of your budget is really signaling a kind of crippling statement about the function of the human imagination in society, about the creative dialogue that people need and desperately want to sustain themselves, to also come up with a future that we can all believe in. Our ability to imagine is directly connected to our ability to imagine a future. And if you cut out the arts, you're basically saying, the hell with the future.
You've been listening to an interview with Tony Taccone, who's the artistic director of Berkeley Rep in Berkeley. The website for more information is berkeleyrep.org. Ruined plays through April 10th. Three Sisters, April 8th through May 22nd. And Anna Deavere Smith, Let Me Down Easy, May 28th through June 26th. I'm Richard Walensky on Open Book.